was once upon a time. Nice master. Smeagol very good. Always helps. Sam frowned. If he could have bored holes in Gollum with his eyes, he would have done. His mind was full of doubt. To all appearances, Gollum was genuinely distressed and anxious to help Frodo. But Sam, remembering the overheard debate, found it hard to believe that the long-submerged Smeagol had come out on top. That voice, at any rate, had not had the last word in the debate. Sam's guess was that the Smeagol and the Gollum halves, or what, in his own mind, he called Slinker and Stinker, had made a truce and a temporary alliance. Neither wanted the enemy to get the ring. Both wished to keep Frodo from capture, and under their eye, as long as possible, at any rate as long as Stinker still had a chance of laying hands on his precious. Whether there really was another way into Mordor, Sam doubted. "And it's a good thing neither half of the old villain don't know what Master means to do," he thought. "If he knew that Mr. Frodo is trying to put an end to his precious for good and all, there'd be trouble pretty quick, I bet. Anyhow, old Stinker's so frightened of the enemy, and he's under orders of some kind from him, or was, that he'd give us away, rather than be caught helping us, and rather than let his precious be melted, maybe. At least that's my idea. And I hope the Master will think it out carefully. He's as wise as any, but he's soft-hearted. That's what he is. It's beyond any Gamgee to guess what he'll do next." Frodo didn't answer Gollum at once. While these thoughts were passing through Sam's slow but shrewd mind, he stood gazing out towards the dark cliff of Kirith Gorgor. The hollow in which they had taken refuge was delved in the side of a low hill, at some little height above a long trench-like valley that lay between it and the outer buttresses of the mountains. In the midst of the valley stood the black foundations of the western watchtower. By morning light, the roads that converged upon the gate of Mordor could now be clearly seen, pale and dusty, one winding back northwards, another dwindling eastwards into the mists that clung about the feet of Ered Lithui, and a third that ran towards him. As it bent sharply round the tower, it entered a narrow defile, and passed not far below the hollow where he stood. Westward to his right it turned, skirting the shoulders of the mountains, and went off southwards into the deep shadows that mantled all the western sides of Epheldoath. Beyond his sight it journeyed on into the narrow land between the mountains and the great river. As he gazed, Frodo became aware that there was a great stir and movement on the plain. It seemed as if whole armies were on the march, though for the most part they were hidden by the reeks and fumes drifting from the fens and wastes beyond. But here and there he caught the gleam of spears and helmets, and over the levels beside the roads horsemen could be seen riding in many companies. He remembered his vision from afar upon Armon Hen so few days before, though now it seemed many years ago. Then he knew that the hope that had for one wild moment stirred in his heart was vain. The trumpets had not rung in challenge, but in greeting. This was no assault upon the Dark Lord by the men of Gondor, risen like avenging ghosts from the graves of Valar long passed away. These were men of other race, out of the wide Eastlands, gathering to the summons of their overlord, armies that had encamped before his gate by night, and now marched in to swell his mounting power. As if suddenly made fully aware of the peril of their position, alone, in the growing light of day, so near to this vast menace, Frodo quickly drew his frail grey hood close upon his head and stepped down into the dell. Then he turned to Gollum. "Smeagol," he said, "I'll trust you once more. Indeed, it seems that I must do so, and that it's my fate to receive help from you, where I least look for it, and your fate to help me, whom you long pursued with evil purpose. So far you've deserved well of me, and have kept your promise truly. Truly, I say and mean," he added with a glance at Sam, "for twice now we've been in your power, and you've done no harm to us, nor have you tried to take from me what you once sought. May the third time prove the best, but I warn you, Smeagol, you are in danger."
"Yes,
"Yes, master," said Gollum. "Dreadful danger. Smeagol's bones shake to think of it. But he doesn't run away. He must help nice master."
"I didn't mean the danger that we all share," said Frodo. "I mean a danger to yourself alone. You swore a promise by what you call the precious. Remember that. It'll hold you to it, but it will seek a way to twist it to your own undoing. Already you are being twisted. You revealed yourself to me just now foolishly. Give it back to Smeagol, you said. Don't say that again. Don't let that thought grow in you. You'll never get it back, but the desire of it may betray you to a bitter end. You'll never get it back. In the last need, Smeagol, I should put on the precious, and the precious mastered you long ago. If I, wearing it, were to command you, you would obey. Even if it were to leap from a precipice or to cast yourself into the fire, and such would be my command. So have a care, Smeagol." Sam looked at his master with approval, but also with surprise. There was a look in his face and a tone in his voice that he hadn't known before. It had always been a notion of his that the kindness of dear Mr. Frodo was of such a high degree that it must imply a fair measure of blindness. Of course, he also firmly held the incompatible belief that Mr. Frodo was the wisest person in the world, with the possible exception of old Mr. Bilbo and of Gandalf. Gollum, in his own way, and with much more excuse as his acquaintance, was much briefer. May have made a similar mistake, confusing kindness and blindness. At any rate, this speech abashed and terrified him. He grovelled on the ground, and could speak no clear words but, "Nice master." Frodo waited patiently for a while, then he spoke again, less sternly. "Come now, Gollum or Smeagol, if you wish. Tell me of this other way, and show me, if you can, what hope there is in it, enough to justify me in turning aside from my plain path. I'm in haste." But Gollum was in a pitiable state, and Frodo's threat had quite unnerved him. It wasn't easy to get any clear account out of him, amid his mumblings and squeakings, and the frequent interruptions in which he crawled on the floor and begged them both to be kind to "poor little Smeagol." After a while he grew a little calmer, and Frodo gathered bit by bit that, if a traveller followed the road that turned west of Ephelduath, he would come in time to a crossing in a circle of dark trees. On the right a road went down to Osgiliath and the bridges of the Anduin. In the middle the road went on southwards.
"On, on, on," said Gollum. "We never went that way, but they say it goes 100 leagues until you can see the great water that is never still. There are lots of fishes there, and big birds eat fishes, nice birds, but we never went there, alas, no. We never had a chance, and further still there are more lands, they say, but the yellow face is very hot there, and there are seldom any clouds, and the men are fierce and have dark faces. We don't want to see that land."
"No," said Frodo, "but don't wander from your road. What of the third turning?"
Oh yes, there is a third way," said Gollum. "That is the road to the left, and once it begins to climb up, up, winding and climbing back towards the tall shadows. When it turns round the black rock, you'll see it. Suddenly you'll see it above you, and you'll want to hide."
"See it? See it? What will you see?"
"The old fortress. Very old, very horrible now. We used to hear tales from the south when Smeagol was young long ago. Oh, yes, we used to tell lots of tales in the evening, sitting by the banks of the great river, in the willow lands, when the river was younger, too. Gollum, Gollum."
He began to weep and mutter. The hobbits waited patiently.
"Tales of the south," Gollum went on again, "about the tall men with the shining eyes, and their houses like hills of stone, and the silver crown of their king and his white tree.
wonderful tales. They built very tall towers, and one they raised was silver-white, and in it there was a stone like the moon, and round it were great white walls. Oh, yes, there were many tales about the Tower of the Moon.
That would be Minas Ithil that Isildur, the son of Elendil, built, said Frodo. It was Isildur who cut off the finger of the enemy.
Yes, he has only 4 on the black hand, but they are enough, said Gollum, shuddering, and he hated Isildur's city.
What does he not hate? Said Frodo. But what has the Tower of the Moon to do with us?
Well, master, there it was, and there it is, the tall tower and the white houses and the wall, but not nice now, not beautiful. He conquered it long ago. It is a terrible place now. Travellers shiver when they see it. They creep out of sight. They avoid its shadow. But master will have to go that way. That is the only other way, for the mountains are lower there, and the old road goes up and up until it reaches a dark pass at the top, and then it goes down, down again to Gorgoroth.
His voice sank to a whisper, and he shuddered.
"But how will that help us?" asked Sam. "Surely the enemy knows all about his own mountains, and that road will be guarded as close as this. The tower isn't empty, is it?"
"Oh, no, not empty," whispered Gollum. "It seems empty, but it isn't. Oh, no, very dreadful things live there. Orcs, yes, always orcs. But worse things live there too. The road climbs right under the shadow of the walls and passes the gate. Nothing moves on the road that they don't know about. The things inside know. The silent watchers."
"So that's your advice, is it?" said Sam. "That we should go another long march south, to find ourselves in the same fix, or a worse one, when we get there, if we ever do?"
"No, no, indeed," said Gollum. "Hobbits must see, must try to understand. He doesn't expect attack that way. His eye is all round, but it attends more to some places than to others. He can't see everything all at once, not yet. You see, he has conquered all the country west of the Shadowy Mountains down to the river, and he holds the bridges now. He thinks no one can come to the Moon Tower without fighting big battle at the bridges, or getting lots of boats which they cannot hide, and he will know about."
"You seem to know a lot about what he's doing and thinking," said Sam. "Have you been talking to him lately, or just hobnobbing with orcs?"
"Not nice, hobbit, not sensible," said Gollum, giving Sam an angry glance and turning to Frodo. "Smeagol has talked to orcs, yes, of course, before he met master, and to many peoples. He has walked very far, and what he says now many peoples are saying. It's here in the north that the big danger is for him and for us. He will come out of the Black Gate one day soon. That is the only way big armies can come. But away down west he is not afraid, and there are the silent watchers."
"Just so," said Sam, not to be put off. "And so we're to walk up and knock at their gate and ask if we're on the right road for Mordor? Or are they too silent to answer? It's not sense. We might as well do it here and save ourselves a long tramp."
"Don't make jokes about it," hissed Gollum. "It isn't funny. Oh, no, not amusing. It's not sense to try and get into Mordor at all. But if master says I must go or I will go, then he must try some way. But he must not go to the terrible city. Oh, no, of course not. That is where Smeagol helps. Nice Smeagol. Though no one tells him what it is all about, Smeagol helps again. He found it. He knows it."
"What did he find?" asked Frodo. Gollum crouched down, and his voice sank to a whisper again.
"A little path leading up into the mountains, and then a stair, a narrow stair. Oh, yes, very long and narrow, and then more stairs. And then," his voice sank even lower, "a tunnel, a dark tunnel, and at last a little cliff. and a path high above the main pass. It was that way that Smeagol got out of the darkness, but it was years ago. The path may have vanished now, but perhaps not, perhaps not.
"I don't like the sound of it at all," said Sam. "Sounds too easy at any rate in the telling. If that path is still there, it'll be guarded too." "Wasn't it guarded, Gollum?"
As he said this, he caught, or fancied he caught, a green gleam in Gollum's eye. Gollum muttered, but did not reply.
"Is it guarded?" asked Frodo sternly. "And did you escape out of the darkness, Smeagol? Were you not rather permitted to depart upon an errand? That, at least, is what Aragorn thought, who found you by the dead marshes some years ago."
"It's a lie!" hissed Gollum,
and an evil light came into his eyes at the naming of Aragorn.
"He lied on me. Yes, he did. I did escape all by my poor self. Indeed, I was told to seek for the precious, and I have searched and searched. Of course I have. But not for the Black One. The precious was ours. It was mine, I tell you. I did escape."
Frodo felt a strange certainty that in this matter Gollum was for once not so far from the truth as might be suspected, that he had somehow found a way out of Mordor, and at least believed that it was by his own cunning. For one thing, he noted that Gollum used "I," and that seemed usually to be a sign, on its rare appearances, that some remnants of old truth and sincerity were for the moment on top. But even if Gollum could be trusted on this point, Frodo didn't forget the wiles of the enemy. The escape may have been allowed or arranged, and well known in the Dark Tower, and in any case Gollum was plainly keeping a good deal back. "I ask you again," he said, "is not this secret way guarded?" But the name of Aragorn had put Gollum into a sullen mood. He had all the injured air of a liar suspected when for once he has told the truth, or part of it. He didn't answer. "Is it not guarded?" Frodo repeated.
"Yes, yes, perhaps. No safe places in this country," said Gollum sulkily. "No safe places. But Master must try it or go home. No other way."
They couldn't get him to say more. The name of the perilous place and the high pass he could not tell, or would not. Its name was Cirith Ungol, a name of dreadful rumour. Aragorn could perhaps have told them that name and its significance. Gandalf would have warned them. But they were alone, and Aragorn was far away, and Gandalf stood amid the ruin of Isengard and strove with Saruman, delayed by treason. Yet even as he spoke his last words to Saruman, and the Palantir crashed in fire upon the steeps of Orthanc, his mind was ever upon Frodo and Samwise. Over the long leagues his mind sought for them in hope and pity. Maybe Frodo felt it, not knowing it, as he had upon Armon Hen. Even though he believed that Gandalf was gone, gone for ever into the shadow in Moria, far away, he sat upon the ground for a long while, silent, his head bowed, striving to recall all that Gandalf had said to him. But for this choice he could recall no counsel. Indeed, Gandalf's guidance had been taken from them too soon, too soon, while the Dark Land was still very far away. How they should enter it at the last Gandalf had not said. Perhaps he could not say. Into the stronghold of the enemy in the north, into Dol Guldur, he had once ventured. But into Mordor, to the Mountain of Fire, and to Barad-dûr, since the Dark Lord rose in power again, had he ever journeyed there? Frodo didn't think so. And here he was, a little halfling from the Shire, a simple hobbit of the quiet countryside, expected to find a way where the great ones could not go, or dared not go. It was an evil fate. But he'd taken it on himself in his own sitting-room in the far-off spring of another year, so remote now that it was like a chapter in a story of the world's youth, when the trees of silver and gold were still in bloom. This was an evil choice. Which way should he choose? And if both led to terror and death, what good lay in choice? The day drew on. A deep silence fell upon the little grey hollow where they lay, so near to the borders of the land of fear, a silence that could be felt, as if it were a thick veil that cut them off from all the world about them. Above them was a dome of pale sky barred with fleeting smoke, but it seemed high and far away, as if seen through great deeps of air, heavy with brooding thought. Not even an eagle poised against the sun would have marked the hobbit sitting there, under the weight of doom, silent, not moving, shrouded in their thin grey cloaks. For a moment he might have paused to consider Gollum, a tiny figure sprawling on the ground. There perhaps lay the famished skeleton of some child of men, its ragged garments still clinging to it, its long arms and legs almost bone-white and bone-thin, no flesh worth a peck. Frodo's head was bowed over his knees, but Sam leaned back, with hands behind his head, staring out of his hood at the empty sky. At least for a long while it was empty. Then presently Sam thought he saw a dark bird-like figure wheel into the circle of his sight, and hover, and then wheel away again. Two more followed, and then a fourth. They were very small to look at, yet he knew, somehow, that they were huge, with a vast stretch of pinion, flying at a great height. He covered his eyes and bent forward, cowering. The same warning fear was on him as he had felt in the presence of the Black Riders, the helpless horror that had come with the cry in the wind and the shadow on the moon, though now it was not so crushing or compelling. The menace was more remote, but menace it was. Frodo felt it too. His thought was broken. He stirred and shivered, but he didn't look up. Gollum huddled himself together like a cornered spider. The winged shapes wheeled and stooped swiftly down, speeding back to Mordor. Sam took a deep breath. "The riders are about again, up in the air," he said in a hoarse whisper. "I saw them. Do you think they could see us? They were very high up. And if they're black riders, same as before, then they can't see much by daylight, can they?" "No, perhaps not," said Frodo. "But their steeds could see. And these winged creatures that they ride on now, they can probably see more than any other creature. They are like great carrion birds. They are looking for something. The enemy is on the watch, I fear." The feeling of dread passed, but the enfolding silence was broken. For some time they had been cut off from the world, as if in an invisible island. Now they were laid bare again. Peril had returned. But still Frodo did not speak to Gollum or make his choice. His eyes were closed, as if he were dreaming, or looking inward into his heart and memory. At last he stirred and stood up, and it seemed that he was about to speak and to decide. But, hark, he said, "What's that?" A new fear was upon them. They heard singing and hoarse shouting. At first it seemed a long way off, but it drew nearer. It was coming towards them. It leapt into all their minds that the black wings had spied them and had sent armed soldiers to seize them. No speed seemed too great for these terrible servants of Sauron. They crouched, listening. The voices and the clink of weapons and harness were very close. Frodo and Sam loosened their small swords in their sheaths. Flight was impossible. Gollum rose slowly and crawled insect-like to the lip of the hollow. Very cautiously he raised himself inch by inch, until he could peer over it between two broken points of stone. He remained there without moving for some time, making no sound. Presently the voices began to recede again, and then they slowly faded away. Far off a horn blew on the ramparts of the Morannon. Then quietly Gollum drew back and slipped down into the hollow.
"More men going to Mordor," he said in a low voice. "Dark faces. We've not seen men like these before. No, Smeagol hasn't. They're fierce. They have black eyes and long black hair and gold rings in their ears. Yes, lots of beautiful gold. And some have red paint on their cheeks and red cloaks, and their flags are red, and the tips of their spears. And they have round shields, yellow and black, with big spikes. Not nice. Very cruel, wicked men they look. Almost as bad as orcs, and much bigger. Smeagol thinks they have come out of the south beyond the great river's end. They came up that road. They have passed on to the Black Gate, but more may follow. Always more people coming to Mordor. One day all the peoples will be inside.
"Were there any Oliphants?" asked Sam, forgetting his fear and his eagerness for news of strange places.
"No, no Oliphants. What are Oliphants?" said Gollum.
Sam stood up, putting his hands behind his back, as he always did when speaking poetry, and began. "Grey as a mouse, big as a house, nose like a snake, I make the earth shake. As I tramp through the grass, trees crack as I pass. With horns in my mouth, I walk in the south, flapping big ears. Beyond count of years, I stump round and round, never lie on the ground, not even to die. Oliphant am I, biggest of all, huge, old, and tall. If ever you'd met me, you wouldn't forget me. If you never do, you won't think I'm true. But old Oliphant am I, and I never lie."
"That," said Sam, when he'd finished reciting, "that's a rhyme we have in the Shire. Nonsense, maybe, and maybe not. But we have our tales, too, and news of the South, you know. In the old days, hobbits used to go on their travels now and again. Not that many ever came back, and not that all they said was believed. News from Bree, and not sure as Shire talk, as the sayings go. But I've heard tales of the big folk down away in the Sunlands. Swertings we call them in our tales, and they ride on Oliphants, 'tis said, when they fight. They put houses and towers on the Oliphants' backs and all, and the Oliphants throw rocks and trees at one another. So when you say, 'Men out of the south, all in red and gold,' I said, 'Were there any Oliphants? For if there was, I was going to take a look. Risk or no, but now I don't suppose I'll ever see an Oliphant. Maybe there ain't no such beast,'" he sighed.
"No, no Oliphants," said Gollum again. "Smeagol hasn't heard of them. He doesn't want to see them. He doesn't want them to be. Smeagol wants to go away from here and hide somewhere safer. Smeagol wants Master to go. Nice Master. Won't he come with Smeagol?"
Frodo stood up. He'd laughed in the midst of all his cares when Sam trotted out the old fireside rhyme of Oliphant, and the laugh had released him from hesitation. "I wish we had 1,000 Oliphants with Gandalf on a white one at their head," he said. "Then we'd break away into this evil land, perhaps. But we've not. Just our own tired legs, that's all. Well, Smeagol, the third turn may turn the best. I will come with you."
"Good Master, wise Master, nice Master," said Gollum in delight, patting Frodo's knees. "Good Master! Then rest thou, nice hobbits, under the shadow of the stones, close under the stones, rest and lie quiet till the yellow face goes away. Then we can go quickly, soft and quick as shadows we must be."
Chapter 4 Of Herbs and Stewed Rabbit. For the few hours of daylight that were left, they rested, shifting into the shade as the sun moved, until at last the shadow of the western rim of their dell grew long, and darkness filled all the hollow. Then they ate a little, and drank sparingly. Gollum ate nothing, but he accepted water gladly.
"Soon get more now," he said, licking his lips. "Good water runs down in streams to the great river. Nice water in the lands we're going to. Smeagol will get food there, too, perhaps. "He's very hungry, yes, Gollum."
He set his two large flat hands on his shrunken belly, and a pale green light came into his eyes. The dusk was deep when at length they set out, creeping over the westward rim of the dell, and fading like ghosts into the broken country on the borders of the road. The moon was now 3 nights from the full, but it didn't climb over the mountains until nearly midnight, and the early night was very dark. A single red light burned high up in the towers of the Teeth, but otherwise no sign could be seen or heard of the sleepless watch on the Morannon. For many miles the red eye seemed to stare at them as they fled, stumbling through a barren, stony country. They didn't dare to take the road, but they kept it on their left, following its line as well as they could at a little distance. At last, when night was growing old, and they were already weary, for they had taken only one short rest, the eye dwindled to a small fiery point and then vanished. They'd turned the dark northern shoulder of the lower mountains and were heading southwards. With hearts strangely lightened, they now rested again, but not for long. They were not going quick enough for Gollum. By his reckoning, it was nearly 30 leagues from the Morannon to the crossroads above Osgiliath, and he hoped to cover that distance in 4 journeys. So soon they struggled on once more until the dawn began to spread slowly in the wide grey solitude. They then walked almost 8 leagues, and the hobbits could not have gone any further, even if they'd dared. The growing light revealed to them a land already less barren and ruinous. The mountains still loomed up ominously on their left, but near at hand they could see the southward road, now bearing away from the black roots of the hills and slanting westwards. Beyond it were slopes covered with sombre trees like dark clouds, but all about them lay a tumbled heathland, grown with ling and broom and cornel, and other shrubs that they didn't know. Here and there they saw knots of tall pine trees. The hearts of the hobbits rose again a little in spite of weariness. The air was fresh and fragrant, and it reminded them of the uplands of the Northfarthing far away. It seemed good to be reprieved, to walk in a land that had only been for a few years under the dominion of the Dark Lord and wasn't yet fallen wholly into decay. But they didn't forget their danger, nor the black gate that was still all too near, hidden though it was behind the gloomy heights. They looked about for a hiding place where they could shelter from evil eyes while the light lasted. The day passed uneasily. They lay deep in the heather and counted out the slow hours in which there seemed little change, for they were still under the shadows of the Ephelduath, and the sun was veiled. Frodo slept at times, deeply and peacefully, either trusting Gollum or too tired to trouble about him. But Sam found it difficult to do more than doze, even when Gollum was plainly fast asleep, whiffling and twitching in his secret dreams. Hunger, perhaps, more than mistrust, kept him wakeful. He had begun to long for a good homely meal, something hot out of the pot. As soon as the land faded into a formless grey under coming night, they started out again. In a little while, Gollum led them down onto the southward road, and after that they went on more quickly, though the danger was greater. Their ears were strained for the sound of hoof or foot on the road ahead, or following them from behind, but the night passed, and they heard no sound of walker or rider. The road had been made in a long-lost time, and for perhaps 30 miles below the Morannon it had been newly repaired. But as it went south, the wild encroached upon it. The handiwork of men of old could still be seen in its straight, sure flight and level course. Now and again it cut its way through hillside slopes, or leapt over a stream upon a wide, shapely arch of enduring masonry. But at last all signs of stonework faded, save for a broken pillar here and there, peering out of bushes at the side,
or old paving stones still lurking amid weeds and moss. Heather and trees and bracken scrambled down and overhung the banks, or sprawled out over the surface. It dwindled at last to a country cart road little used. But it didn't wind. It held on its own sure course and guided them by the swiftest way. So they passed into the northern marches of that land that men once called Ithilien, a fair country of climbing woods and swift-falling streams. The night became fine under star and round moon, and it seemed to the hobbits that the fragrance of the air grew as they went forward, and from the blowing and muttering of Gollum it seemed that he noticed it too, and didn't relish it. At the first signs of day they halted again. They'd come to the end of a long cutting, deep and sheer-sided in the middle, by which the road clove its way through a stony ridge. Now they climbed up the westward bank and looked abroad. Day was opening in the sky, and they saw that the mountains were now much further off, receding eastward in a long curve that was lost in the distance. Before them, as they turned west, gentle slopes ran down into dim hazes far below. All about them were small woods of resinous trees, fir and cedar and cypress, and other kinds unknown in the Shire, with wide glades among them, and everywhere there was a wealth of sweet-smelling herbs and shrubs. The long journey from Rivendell had brought them far south of their own land, but not until now, in this more sheltered region, had the hobbits felt the change of clime. Here spring was already busy about them. Fronds pierced moss and mould, larches were green-fingered, small flowers were opening in the turf, birds were singing. Ithilien, the garden of Gondor, now desolate, kept still a dishevelled, dryad loveliness. South and west it looked towards the warm lower vales of Anduin, shielded from the east by the Ethelduath, and yet not under the mountain shadow, protected from the north by the Emynweal, open to the southern airs and the moist winds from the sea far away. Many great trees grew there, planted long ago, falling into untended age amid a riot of careless descendants, and groves and thickets there were, of tamarisk and pungent terebinth, of olive and of bay, and there were junipers and myrtles, and thymes that grew in bushes, or with their woody creeping stems mantled in deep tapestries the hidden stones, sages of many kinds putting forth blue flowers, or red, or pale green, and marjorams and new sprouting parsleys, and many herbs of forms and scents beyond the garden lore of Sam. The grots and rocky walls were already starred with saxifrages and stone crops. Primeroles and anemones were awake in the filbert brakes, and asphodel and many lily flowers nodded their half-opened heads in the grass. Deep green grass beside the pools, where falling streams halted in cool hollows on their journey down to Anduin. The travellers turned their backs on the road and went downhill. As they walked, brushing their way through bush and herb, sweet odours rose about them. Gollum coughed and retched, but the hobbits breathed deep, and suddenly Sam laughed, for heart's ease, not for jest. They followed a stream that went quickly down before them. Presently it brought them to a small, clear lake in a shallow dell. It lay in the broken ruins of an ancient stone basin, the carven rim of which was almost wholly covered with mosses and rose brambles. Iris swords stood in ranks about it, and water lily leaves floated on its dark, gently rippling surface. But it was deep and fresh, and spilled ever softly out over a stony lip at the far end. Here they washed themselves, and drank their fill at the infalling freshet. Then they sought for a resting place and a hiding place, for this land, fair-seeming still, was none the less now territory of the enemy. They'd not come very far from the road, and yet even in so short a space they'd seen scars of the old wars, and the newer wounds made by the orcs and other foul servants of the Dark Lord, a pit of uncovered filth and refuse, trees hewn down wantonly and left to die, with evil runes or the fell sign of the eye cut in rude strokes on their bark. Sam, scrambling below the outfall of the lake, smelling and touching the unfamiliar plants and trees, forgetful for the moment of Mordor, was reminded suddenly of their ever-present peril. He stumbled on a ring still scorched by fire, and in the midst of it he found a pile of charred and broken bones and skulls. The swift growth of the wild with briar and eglantine and trailing clematis was already drawing a veil over this place of dreadful feast and slaughter. But it wasn't ancient. He hurried back to his companions, but he said nothing. The bones were best left in peace and not pawed and routed by Gollum. "Let's find a place to lie up in," he said. "Not lower down, higher up for me." A little way back above the lake they found a deep brown bed of last year's fern. Beyond it was a thicket of dark-leaved bay trees climbing up a steep bank that was crowned with old cedars. Here they decided to rest and pass the day, which already promised to be bright and warm. A good day for strolling on their way along the groves and glades of Ithilien. But though orcs may shun the sunlight, there were too many places here where they could lie hid and watch. And other evil eyes were abroad. Sauron had many servants. Gollum, in any case, wouldn't move under the yellow face. Soon it would look over the dark ridges of the Ethelduath, and he would faint and cower in the light and heat. Sam had been giving earnest thought to food as they marched. Now that the despair of the impassable gate was behind him, he didn't feel so inclined as his master to take no thought for their livelihood beyond the end of their errand. And anyway it seemed wiser to him to save the waybread of the elves for worse times ahead. 6 days or more had passed since he reckoned that they had only a bare supply for 3 weeks. "If we reach the fire in that time, we'll be lucky at this rate," he thought, "and we might be wanting to get back. We might." Besides, at the end of a long night march, and after bathing and drinking, he felt even more hungry than usual. A supper, or a breakfast, by the fire in the old kitchen at Bagshot Row was what he really wanted. An idea struck him, and he turned to Gollum. Gollum had just begun to sneak off on his own, and he was crawling away on all fours through the fern.
"Hi, Gollum," said Sam. "Where are you going?"
"Hunting? Well, see here, old noser, you don't like our food, and I'd not be sorry for a change myself. Your new motto's always ready to help. Could you find anything fit for a hungry hobbit?"
"Yes, perhaps yes," said Gollum. "Smeagol always helps if they asks nicely."
"Right," said Sam. "I does ask, and if that isn't nice enough, I begs." Gollum disappeared. He was away some time, and Frodo, after a few mouthfuls of lembas, settled deep into the brown fern and went to sleep. Sam looked at him. The early daylight was only just creeping down into the shadows under the trees, but he saw his master's face very clearly, and his hands, too, lying at rest on the ground beside him. He was reminded suddenly of Frodo, as he'd lain asleep in the house of Elrond after his deadly wound. Then, as he'd kept watch, Sam had noticed that at times a light seemed to be shining faintly within, but now the light was even clearer and stronger. Frodo's face was peaceful. The marks of fear and care had left it, but it looked old, old and beautiful, as if the chiselling of the shaping years was now revealed in many fine lines that had before been hidden, though the identity of the face was not changed. Not that Sam Gamgee put it that way to himself. He shook his head, as if finding words useless, and murmured, "I love him. He's like that, and sometimes it shines through somehow. But I love him, whether or no. Gollum returned quietly and peered over Sam's shoulder. Looking at Frodo, he shut his eyes and crawled away without a sound. Sam came to him a moment later and found him chewing something and muttering to himself. On the ground beside him lay two small rabbits, which he was beginning to eye greedily.
"Smeagol always helps," he said. "He's brought rabbits, nice rabbits. But Master has gone to sleep, and perhaps Sam wants to sleep. Doesn't want rabbits now. Smeagol tries to help, but he can't catch things all in a minute."
Sam, however, had no objection to rabbit at all, and said so. At least not to cooked rabbits. All hobbits, of course, can cook, for they begin to learn the art before their letters, which many never reach. But Sam was a good cook, even by hobbit reckoning, and he'd done a good deal of the camp cooking on their travels when there was a chance. He still hopefully carried some of his gear in his pack, a small tinder box, two small shallow pans, the smaller fitting into the larger, inside them a wooden spoon, a short two-pronged fork, and some skewers were stowed, and hidden at the bottom of the pack in a flat wooden box a dwindling treasure, some salt. But he needed a fire, and other things besides. He thought for a bit, while he took out his knife, cleaned and wetted it, and began to dress the rabbits. He wasn't going to leave Frodo alone asleep even for a few minutes.
"Now, Gollum," he said, "I've another job for you. Go and fill these pans with water and bring it back."
"Smeagol will fetch water, yes," said Gollum. "But what does the hobbit want all that water for? He's drunk, he's washed."
"Never you mind," said Sam. "If you can't guess, you'll soon find out. And the sooner you fetch the water, the sooner you'll learn. Don't you damage one of my pans, or I'll carve you into mincemeat." While Gollum was away, Sam took another look at Frodo. He was still sleeping quietly, but Sam was now struck most by the leanness of his face and hands.
"Too thin and drawn he is," he muttered. "Not right for a hobbit. If I can get these conies cooked, I'm going to wake him up."
Sam gathered a pile of the driest fern, and then scrambled up the bank, collecting a bundle of twigs and broken wood. The fallen branch of a cedar at the top gave him a good supply. He cut out some turves at the foot of the bank, just outside the fern break, and made a shallow hole and laid his fuel in it. Being handy with flint and tinder, he soon had a small blaze going. It made little or no smoke, but gave off an aromatic scent. He was just stooping over his fire, shielding it and building it up with heavier wood, when Gollum returned, carrying the pans carefully and grumbling to himself. He set the pans down, and then suddenly saw what Sam was doing. He gave a thin, hissing shriek, and seemed to be both frightened and angry.
"Ash! Shh! No!" he cried. "No, silly hobbits! Foolish, yes, foolish! They mustn't do it!"
"Mustn't do what?" asked Sam in surprise.
"Not make the nasty red tongues," hissed Gollum. "Fire! Fire! It's dangerous! Yes, it is! It burns! It kills! And it will bring enemies! Yes, it will!"
"I don't think so," said Sam. "Don't see why it should, if you don't put wet stuff on it and make a smother. But if it does, it does. I'm going to risk it anyhow. I'm going to stew these conies."
"Stew the rabbits!" squealed Gollum in dismay. "Spoil beautiful meat Smeagol saved for you, poor hungry Smeagol! What for? What for, silly hobbit? They're young, they're tender, they're nice. Eat them, eat them!"
He clawed at the nearest rabbit, already skinned and lying by the fire.
"Now, now," said Sam, "each to his own fashion. Our bread chokes you, and raw coney chokes me. If you give me a coney, the coney's mine, see, to cook if I have a mind, and I have. You needn't watch me. Go and catch another and eat it as you fancy. Somewhere private and out of my sight. Then you won't see the fire, and I shan't see you,
and we'll both be the happier. I'll see the fire don't smoke, if that's any comfort to you."
Gollum withdrew grumbling, and crawled into the fern. Sam busied himself with his pans. "What a hobbit needs with coney," he said to himself, "is some herbs and roots, especially taters, not to mention bread. Herbs we can manage, seemingly." "Gollum," he called softly.
"Third time pays for all. I want some herbs."
Gollum's head peeped out of the fern, but his looks were neither helpful nor friendly.
"A few bay leaves, some thyme and sage will do, before the water boils," said Sam.
"No," said Gollum. "Smeagol is not pleased, and Smeagol doesn't like smelly leaves. He doesn't eat grasses or roots, no, precious, not till he's starving or very sick, poor Smeagol."
"Smeagol'll get into real true hot water when this water boils, if he don't do as he's asked," growled Sam. "Sam'll put his head in it, yes, precious, and I'll make him look for turnips and carrots and taters too. If it was the time of the year, I'll bet there's all sorts of good things running wild in this country. I'd give a lot for half a dozen taters."
"Smeagol won't go. Oh, no, precious, not this time," hissed Gollum. "He's frightened, and he's very tired, and this hobbit's not nice, not nice at all. Smeagol won't grub for roots and carrots and taters. What's taters, precious, eh? What's taters?"
"Potatoes," said Sam. "The gaffer's delight, and rare good ballast for an empty belly. But you won't find any, so you needn't look. But be good, Smeagol, and fetch me the herbs, and I'll think better of you. What's more, if you turn over a new leaf, and keep it turned, I'll cook you some taters one of these days, I will. Fried fish and chips served by S. Gamgee. You couldn't say no to that."
"Yes, yes, we could. Spoiling nice fish, scorching it. Give me fish now, and keep nasty chips."
"Oh, you're hopeless," said Sam. "Go to sleep."
In the end, he had to find what he wanted for himself. But he didn't have to go far, not out of sight of the place where his master lay, still sleeping. For a while Sam sat musing, and tending the fire till the water boiled. The daylight grew, and the air became warm. The dew faded off turf and leaf. Soon the rabbits cut up lay simmering in their pans with the bunched herbs. Almost Sam fell asleep as the time went by. He let them stew for close on an hour, testing them now and again with his fork, and tasting the broth. When he thought all was ready, he lifted the pans off the fire and crept along to Frodo. Frodo half opened his eyes as Sam stood over him, and then he wakened from his dreaming, another gentle, unrecoverable dream of peace. "Hello, Sam," he said, "not resting. Is anything wrong? What's the time?"
"About a couple of hours after daybreak," said Sam, "and nigh on 8:30 by shire clocks, maybe. But nothing's wrong, though it ain't quite what I'd call right. No stock, no onions, no taters. I've got a bit of stew for you, and some broth, Mr. Frodo. Do you good. You'll have to sup it in your mug, or straight from the pan when it's cooled a bit. I haven't brought no bowls, nor nothing proper."
Frodo yawned and stretched.
"You should have been resting, Sam," he said. "And lighting a fire was dangerous in these parts. But I do feel hungry. Can I smell it from here? What have you stewed?"
"A present from Smeagol," said Sam. "A brace of young conies, though I fancy Gollum's regretting them now. But there's naught to go with them but a few herbs."
Sam and his master sat down within the fern brake and ate their stew from the pans, sharing the old fork and spoon. They allowed themselves half a piece of the elvish whey bread each. It seemed a feast.
"Whee! Gollum!" Sam called and whistled softly. "Come on! Still time to change your mind. There's some left, if you want to try some stewed coney."
There was no answer.
"Oh, well, I suppose he's gone off to find something for himself. We'll finish it," said Sam.
"'And then you must take some sleep,' said Frodo.
"'Don't you drop off while I'm nodding, Mr. Frodo. "'I don't feel too sure of him. "'There's a good deal of Stinker, the bad Gollum, if you understand me, in him still, "'and it's getting stronger again. "'Not but what I think he'd try to throttle me first now. "'We don't see eye to eye, and he's not pleased with Sam. "'Oh, no, precious, not pleased at all.' "'They finished.' And Sam went off to the stream to rinse his gear. As he stood up to return, he looked back to the slope. At that moment he saw the sun rise out of the reeks, or haze, or dark shadow, or whatever it was, that lay ever to the east, and it sent its golden beams down upon the trees and glades about him. Then he noticed a thin spiral of blue-grey smoke, plain to see as it caught the sunlight, rising from a thicket above him. With a shock, he realized that this was the smoke from his little cooking fire, which he'd neglected to put out. "That won't do. Never thought it would show like that," he muttered, and he started to hurry back. Suddenly he halted and listened. Had he heard a whistle or not? Or was it the call of some strange bird? If it was a whistle, it didn't come from Frodo's direction. There it went again, from another place. Sam began to run as well as he could uphill. He found that a small brand, burning away to its outer end, had kindled some fern at the edge of the fire, and the fern blazing up had set the turf smouldering. Hastily he stamped out what was left of the fire, scattering the ashes, and laid the turves on the hole. Then he crept back to Frodo.
"Did you hear a whistle? And what sounded like an answer?" he asked. "A few minutes back. I hope it was only a bird, but it didn't sound quite like that. More like somebody mimicking a bird call, I thought. And I'm afraid my bit of fire's been smoking. Now if I've gone and brought trouble, I'll never forgive myself, nor won't have a chance, maybe." "Hush," whispered Frodo. "I thought I heard voices."
The two hobbits trussed their small packs, put them on ready for flight, and then crawled deeper into the fern. There they crouched, listening. There was no doubt of the voices. They were speaking low and furtively, but they were near, and coming nearer. Then, quite suddenly, one spoke clearly close at hand.
"Here. Here's where the smoke came from," it said.
"'Twill be nigh at hand. In the fern, no doubt. We shall have it like a coney in a trap. Then we shall learn what kind of thing it is."
"Aye, and what it knows," said a second voice.
At once four men came striding through the fern from different directions. Since flight and hiding were no longer possible, Frodo and Sam sprang to their feet, putting back to back and whipping out their small swords. If they were astonished at what they saw, their captors were even more astonished. Four tall men stood there. Two had spears in their hands with broad, bright heads. Two had great bows, almost of their own height, and great quivers of long, green-feathered arrows. All had swords at their sides, and were clad in green and brown of varied hues, as if the better to walk unseen in the glades of Ithilien. Green gauntlets covered their hands, and their faces were hooded and masked with green, except for their eyes, which were very keen and bright. At once Frodo thought of Boromir, for these men were like him in stature and bearing, and in their manner of speech.
"We have not found what we sought," said one. "But what have we found?"
"Not orcs," said another, releasing the hilt of his sword, which he had seized when he saw the glitter of sting in Frodo's hand.
"Elves?"
said a third, doubtfully.
"Nay, not elves," said the fourth, the tallest,
and, as it appeared, the chief among them.
"Elves don't walk in Ithilien in these days, and elves are wondrous fair to look upon, or so to said."
"Meaning we're not, I take it," said Sam. "Thank you kindly. And when you've finished discussing us, perhaps you'll say who you are, and why you can't let two tired travellers rest."
The tall green man laughed grimly.
"I am Faramir, captain of Gondor," he said. "But there are no travellers in this land, only the servants of the Dark Tower, or of the White.
But we are neither, said Frodo, and travellers we are, whatever Captain Faramir may say.
Then make haste to declare yourselves and your errand, said Faramir. We have a work to do, and this is no time or place for riddling or parrying. Come, where's the third of your company?